Please be seated.
Oh, good morning, everybody. I'll just do a brief call through just to see who is in the room and then a couple of matters that we need to discuss, first being the joint witness statements and secondly the minute that I released regarding deemed priorities. So, Mr. Moore and Ms. Mahop for Regional Council, good morning to you. Ms. Baker Galloway. Good morning. Ms. Irving. All right. Any party who is here who wishes to be introduced? Like LandPro, I'm sure you're here. You should be. So, Ms. Perkins, is it? All right. Anybody else?
Good morning.
Oh, good morning to you. Okay. All right. Very good. So, two things. We've got four joint witness statements which represents a mammoth piece of work. And I understand, both from reading the technical joint witness statements and also the last planning statement, but that work's not complete. So we need to talk about what directions do we put in place to ensure that it is completed, that people give over the time required to get the job done and done well. We had done a brief audit ourselves of the joint witness statement, the technical briefs, and noted a number of things that needed to be finished. Not sure that they are all finished in the planning statement, didn't have a time to do the equivalent task. So how do you see this working? We can, again, offer the services of now Deputy Commissioner Ross Dunlop, so he's formally joined the ranks, rejoined the ranks, so we can offer his services, is it the case that people ought to be making best efforts to sort those matters out themselves and fall back, is Mr. Dunn, Commissioner Dunlop?
Yeah.
The experts to do some work without troubling Mr. Dunlop.
Mm-hmm.
Deputy Commissioner Dunlop?
Deputy Commissioner Dunlop.
Without troubling him for the next probably week or so to see whether some of the loose ends can be tidied up.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, then scheduling some further conferencing for the period of time between the end of this tranche of hearing and the next Cromwell week.
Yeah.
I think there's a two-week gap between... Mm-hmm. those two tranches.
Okay.
And we'll know probably later this week as to whether we need to get some formal directions in place to further facilitate that conferencing.
Mm. Okay. So you're not seeking a direction now for people to pull finger and continue with the work that they've done, or are you satisfied that they will do so?
I need to engage again with the council's planner, but more particularly the council's technical team, because there has been some further discussion, as I understand it, directly between parties and or their experts to see, well, I understand there has been, and I just don't know whether that has concluded yet.
Mm. Okay. So how about this? We'll let... the technical team and planners confer over the next week. But if progress is not made, or if one party considers progress is not being made such that a further joint witness statement can be lodged in 3 weeks hence, so that's 2 weeks in Cromwell plus another week, if there's any doubt about that, parties are to ask for direction and all witnesses will be referred into direct conferencing at short order, which means all witnesses are to be available. I want to know what progress is being made by the time we rise next Wednesday. I think by then, but next Wednesday, you will know, you will not know. You'll have a good idea whether people are actually committing themselves to the process. And if they can't, I will direct them to. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Very good.
Is that both the technical team and the planners?
Yes, I think it is both. There's, yes. But it looked like significant progress had been made, but each of the statements concluded with some text saying that that they ran out of time to do almost the concluding piece of work. and I think both groups would benefit from a little more time.
Good. All right. So report by next Wednesday. Actually, I'll ask you to report to the court because you're going to be here next Wednesday. And I will probably issue a short minute to say that if the report is that insufficient progress is being made by next Wednesday, court will refer technical and planning witnesses to expert conferencing in the adjournment between the Cromwell sitting weeks. Okay, very good. So, priorities. So we issued a minute about priorities because still at this point in time we do not have a sense as to the significance of any remaining significance of priorities. And so we'll be asking questions of farming witnesses and also, you know, the experts to come on behalf of farming interests, which are not generalised questions where, you know, the answer is, you know, tossed off, yeah, they're important, or yes, there will be chaos or whatever. But we're really trying to dig into what is known, if anything, about the exercise of those priorities. It seems to us that the government had a transitional provision for deemed permits for a period of 30 years, which is to finally expire on 1 October 2021. That's obviously a matter of submission, but that the government had assumed that when it did expire that there would be a fit-for-purpose water plan, which would take over those priorities in the form of minimum flows, allocation limits and so forth. Well, that's not the case, and so there's a potential gap. But is that significant or not? Do we even know whether these priorities are being exercised or not? Are these priorities taken over by water share agreements or by some other methods that we're just simply not aware of? Because what this plan change is seeking to do, as I understand it, is to ensure that there's an orderly transition from the operative water plan to something else, which is the land and water plan, compliant with the NPS for Freshwater Management 2020. So we're bridging a gap. And so the focus of the court's particular interest is on, are there any missing elements within that gap, accepting, as we must, that there is no plan in place that will enable new plan in place or fit-for-purpose plan in place that necessarily enables the determination of minimum flows and allocation limits. So we're not best assisted by generalised statements. We're looking to or testing the witnesses to see what it is that they know, what it is that they can provide the court so that the court can factor that into their our thinking in terms of are there any elements which can and should be brought forward which haven't been brought forward to date. So that's our particular interest in it. Now, it may well be that permits priorities survive 1 October 2021. Now, that's fine. But should they just simply be brought into the plan by citing the name priorities as if that meant anything to any decision maker in the future? Suspect not. Suspect that that would have been insufficient in and of itself. So we need to talk to people about that. What other? If it's to be brought forward because they have survived, then what should we be doing to recognise those? But if priorities don't survive 1 October 2021 but are important, then what other methods are available to us to recognise the work being done by priorities as between abstractors? And should our interest be as between abstractors only, which is what we think priorities are about, or should it have an environmental focus, which is a particular interest in DOC, Director General Conservation? So we'll be, again, looking to our alternatives if priorities don't survive, but there's a gap. How should the can the gap be bridged? How should it be bridged? So that's our interest in this. And I cannot emphasise enough that the court is simply not assisted by generalised statements about priorities or about water permits. There is way too much at stake to continue to give evidence like that. So that's a terse word, a terse note, but there is far too much at stake for the farming communities to be continuing on in that vein. All right. But we think we've got the right people in the room, particularly also when we start to hear from farmers, because they should know. Anything arising? Good. Okay, so we're back with Ms. Dicey for the court's questions.
Yes, are you happy to hear from Ms. Dicey first this morning?
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Are you sure? Mm. Okay, I'll call Ms. Dicey back to you in the box. Ms. Dicey, I'll leave you with the court.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Ms. Dicey.
Good morning.
And good to see you back again. I'm going to hand you over to Commissioner Edmonds for her questions.
Good morning. Good morning. I've had the benefit of the transcript, so I'm going to take the opportunity to ask you some follow-up questions on a number of matters that I am unclear about, and I'll be looking for more than just a restatement of what you said in the transcript. I'll be looking to get some more information out of you. So I'd just like to start by exploring your experience with preparing resource consent applications. So would you be able to just briefly explain to me, in terms of your experience, what is your experience with that in recent times, particularly as it relates to deemed permits?
Sure. So in recent times, a lot of the applications that we've been working on actually... We started work a number of years ago. Often the applicants, the permit holders will contact us and say, you know, we need to replace our application, and it was a number of years out from 2021, from this year. And our work particularly has centred on group applications, and that started with the Kyburn. And then the Lindis were the two main group applications initially, but a lot of smaller subcatchments as well. So the Pigburn is an example, a group of private permit holders in the Pullburn, and then more recently the Manahirikia are some of the main ones that I've been involved in. And so the early days is establishing who wants to be part of that group and establishing principles for the group. And the evidence of Ms. McKee goes into that in some details, the kind of the principled approach, because it is a huge shift for a lot of these permit holders to go from often individual competitive approach, potentially within the water space, to actually shifting to a group approach. And the group approach was something that was promoted quite strongly from the regional council. There was a plan change, and I forget the number of the plan change, I'm sorry, a number of years ago now, to facilitate the shift from deemed permits to resource consents with expiry in 2021. And that was seen as a helpful approach, both in terms of managing the effects effectively, but also transitioning from priorities and a individualistic approach to a shared approach to water management, both for the users and for the environment. And so we start with the principles, and I could refer to those in Ms. McKeague's evidence if that's helpful, but it's generally along the lines of understanding what the environmental needs are, and then nobody gains to the detriment of another water user, and then working through what that means. And so very much starting with the science and understanding the ecology, the hydrology of the stream. In the past, it also involved a lot of engagement with stakeholders, so in particular the DOC, Aukaha and Fish and Game. And often it was requesting input from those parties as to their values in relation to the particular waterways, and sometimes running field days with those parties as well. More recently, that has become challenging because we've had strong indication from both Aukaha and Fish and Game that they wouldn't give written approvals for more than a six-year consent, and so it became more difficult to actually engage on the particular effects of a waterway, or else we had trouble, particularly with Aukaha, getting the representatives, except for a science rep, to come on site and actually view the stream. And then it was about just preparing the application, working through how water had been used on the property. And for a lot of these applicants, it was the first time ever, sometimes, that a really comprehensive understanding of their system of water use had actually been kind of documented. Some of them had already replaced deemed permits or mining rights into either deemed permits or water permits. So they still had the status under the regional plan as primary allocation because they were originally granted prior to 98. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought there. It was the first time that a lot of them had been comprehensively documented. So for the large irrigation schemes, the Ida Valley Irrigation Company is an example of that, the Manahira Kia and their irrigation cooperative society as well, and is another good example. Very large, complex systems of moving water around. A lot of permits covering activities, sometimes, discharge, retakes and actual takes covering the same locations. So there was a whole lot of detail to kind of shake out and try and put into a clear kind of story, if you like.
And so how many of those have you been developed through to the application stage?
Oh, I'd have to do a count-up.
Well, just a rough estimate.
20 or more.
So that are those individual applications or sub-catchments or catchments you're talking about when you give me that number, or just individual applications?
Some of them are individuals and some of them are sub-catchments. The Manahira Kia is an example where one application or one applicant can represent. So with the Manahira Kia Irrigation Cooperative Society, that represents in excess of 300 water users, I think.
So you've worked on that one and got yes. it to the resource consent application
yes, so
stage.
And
it's now been lodged, I understand.
It's been lodged. And so the Manahira Kia is a really interesting example, actually. I don't think, I'm not aware of anything quite like it in the country. We've worked cooperatively with my company and two other companies, LandPro and OPS or WSP, have worked cooperatively as consultants with clients throughout the Manahira Kia to develop a joint process for the Manahira Kia. And that was really because of the vacuum in terms of limit setting.
Oh, that was going to be my next question. These examples that, yeah. that you've been involved with, how many of them are in catchments with schedule, in Schedule 2A that actually have allocation limits and minimum flows, or well, most of them do. How many in that situation?
Well, so the Manuhirikia, it's a bit of an odd one because there is a Schedule 2A limit, but that bites in terms of allocation. So that allocation cap exists where the sum of consented is greater than the Schedule 2A limit, and that applies to the whole catchment. There is a minimum flow set at OFA, but that has never, I think, been reached, the minimum flow, and I think that's because of augmentation from Falls Dam partly. So it's a very complex catchment from a hydrological level perspective, sorry. And it's recognised that new flow limits have been worked on, and we had requested repeatedly to the Regional Council to develop an NPS-compliant framework for the Manuhirikia ahead of the deemed permit expiry. At one stage, the Regional Council was only going to set a minimum flow, and we asked specifically of the Council that include an allocation limit because it had to be a fully NPS-compliant framework. Because that framework was not being developed, the catchment realised that, and this was before PC7 was even on the radar, had been thought about, that the applicants would basically have to fill that gap themselves. And so the catchment came together. And this is a big catchment where, you know, the water users don't all know each other, and come up with a cohesive approach that was as NPS compliant as an applicant could possibly do. And I know there are always going to be shortfalls with that coming from an applicant, but it was an attempt to fill that gap as much as possible. In other catchments, the Pigburn is a tributary of the Tyree, and so there is a minimum flow and a allocation limit in the Tyree, and so that one was about setting residual flows, the same with the Kyburn. So that had a minimum flow and an allocation limit. And then several tributaries to the Clutha. And now they're a bit funny because they also have an allocation limit. They're not the sum of the consented max, but they're the other default in the primary allocation policy.
Oh, the policy, which I think there's been some criticism of the...
In terms of
policy.
Yeah, yes. Well, it's the how you determine what the primary allocation is. So all the TRIBs going into the Clutha are also subject to an allocation limit, and no more water is available to be granted in those tributaries either. So that's that's an awful lot of waterways with an awful lot of deemed permits sprinkled along them. Although the majority are not in those TRIBs, I'd say the majority of deemed permits. The Manuhirikia, the Tairi, Arrow, Cadrona, I think, are the biggest concentration. But these other TRIBs are subject to an allocation limit, but no scheduled minimum flow. And so there it was about residual flows. And on some of those TRIBs, there may only be one water user, or there could be several.
So if they all got... the ones you've worked on, do they all have residual flows proposed where there's no allocation limit?
So there's an allocation limit.
Sorry,
in almost all of those.
With or without an allocation limit, do they all have residual flows,
so
or
in terms
only
of,
those ones with the allocation limit?
So in terms of our applications, every application we've worked on, we assess the need for a residual flow. In some cases where the waterway dries up naturally below the take and the hydrology supports that, we haven't always proposed a residual flow because leaving a residual flow and then it's going to drop to ground anyways, the river naturally or the stream wouldn't naturally support values downstream of the take anyway. So sometimes that's a consideration. Or a factor. but in every case we assess the need for a residual flow. And so that's one of the considerations that's critical in the development of those applications. That's one of the key mechanisms to manage the effects of TAKES.
So do you you're also doing applications outside of the 2A, Schedule 2A water bodies, are you?
Yep, so those are those the tributaries that feed into the Clutha River. And so Long Gully is an example there. We've done the Bannockburn, which is an incredibly complicated system of using waterways and retakes and then private rights being taken at the same location as company water. And so that's a very complicated, probably the most complicated one I've seen. And again, that's been done at a group scale. And a range of residual flows proposed as part of that application. And so that's not a 2A catchment.
Not a 2A catchment, yeah. But I suppose I was trying to understand whether there was a difference in an approach, given that you've got the allocation limits and the minimum flows in the Schedule 2A ones, but you haven't in the ones outside that. So you've mentioned residual flows, but what about other mechanisms?
Other mechanisms is the flow sharing agreement, and that is, as Mr. Hickey said, that's one of the mechanisms used to help transition away from the priorities. In the Manahiri Care, we've proposed a minimum flow for the main stem of the Manahiri Care and a system of integrated residual flows. So not only TAKE-specific residual flows, but residual flows at the downstream end of key tributaries feeding into the main stem. And so there's a whole system of kind of integrated water management that's proposed with the Manahiri Care catchment, and that's focused on where critical values are, understanding, say, fish passage, understanding, you know, where the particular habitat values are for particular species, and also considered water quality effects. So all of those reports have all got kind of detailed analysis of water quality and trying to link those back to land uses and what may need to shift in the future to address that. I think Mr. Hickey talked in detail about the hotspot, identifying hotspots within the catchment with the Thompson's Creek wetland project. And so they're probably some of the key other factors, the drive to improve efficiency in terms of water use. And that's been a response to both the operative plan and the national policy statements. And so on-farm commitments to on-farm changes, particularly in the past, we've seen a slowdown of that recently with PC7, where it's much more just about holding steady because of the uncertainty.
Well, I guess that was a question I had. I mean, you've talked about the bigger process that you're working on, and then PC7 comes along.
Yeah.
So is it capable then of being addressed in terms of controlled activity under PC7?
All of those wider matters?
Well, I'm not sure all of those wider matters are. That's the purpose of my question. I mean, what could be achieved, I suppose I'm asking you, through the controlled activity status that's now being proposed?
I think, in my opinion, it has to be a controlled activity, and I guess this reflects the evolution of my thinking from the permitted activity, now a simple controlled activity pathway, as a very process orientated pathway, because all of those other considerations, they're complex, they're not necessarily agreed with by other stakeholders. You know, the first proposal was not something necessarily that all stakeholders will agree with. So that's a complex process of assessment by the regional council, input from other stakeholders, and they require often, as soon as there's a change, a loss of reliability of supply, which comes with residual flows, adherence to a minimum flow, then that requires changes on farm, and that can be putting in storage to address loss of reliability of supply from the river source, or changing your infrastructure on farm. And as soon as you trigger any kind of change like that, then a short term of consent, there's just a complete mismatch there between the two. I think this process is incredibly hard on the permit holders, and so I think that the simplest approach possible to allow them to get through this stage, and for everybody in Otago, all stakeholders, to actually focus on the limit setting, would actually, you know, be the most helpful in terms of, you know, if we're talking about the controlled activity rule.
So can you just run that past me again? I lost the thread of what you were saying at the end. So I've asked you a question about the controlled activity pathway and what that may be capable of achieving over the short term. And I wasn't clear about your answer.
I don't think it can achieve anything environmentally or from an efficiency perspective. I think it can only be a simple process, or it should only be a simple process rollover, because if you require anything else that can require on-farm changes, which requires investment, financing, which won't be possible to obtain because there's only a six-year permit and a lot of uncertainty about the future. So I think there's really, through the controlled activity pathway, I think it's process orientated rather than process plus. Is that a more helpful answer?
Yes, I think that is. Thank you. So the next area I wanted to understand a bit better from looking at the transcript is this whole question of priorities. We haven't had anything very definite about priorities. We've had a lot of
general.
And also quite a lot of speculation as to what may or may not be happening. We've had no actual examples provided of where priorities have been exercised and reasons for the exercise, and even the methods for the exercise. You have talked about dial-up and that in a general sense, but in terms of some concrete examples of priorities, presumably when you're working on these, towards these applications and on these applications, the discussions that you're having are surely going to have the word priority mentioned more than a little, and people coming to the table probably take it that they're, well, I've got these priorities, that actually puts me in a better position.
Would
that be right?
Yes, absolutely. So, and that again goes back to those principles and the fact that with a lot of these groups in particular, we've been working with them for years now. And partly the reason for them coming together as a group is because there are priorities, and they understand that priorities are going to finish, and what then? And so an example where priorities have been used is the Kyburn, and that was one of the earlier applications that went through, and I can give you some, you know, a little bit more about that one. The other one is the Pigburn, and that is actually one of the examples I included in my supplementary evidence was from the Pigburn, and in that one it's quite an unusual system of the order, because I think some of the lower priorities are downstream and the highest priority is the second most upstream water take of the kind of downstream reach. There's one way up in the hills that doesn't really affect anybody else. And so their priorities were used, particularly between priority one and a lower priority who is situated higher in the catchment, so between those two water users, and then further down between another two water users. And so working with the group, many of the early meetings were about things such as priorities and access to water, and they were critical. You know, throughout Otago, I think where priorities have been used and where people have held higher priorities, it's affected land values. That's yes. How critical they were. And so with the Pigburn example, as part of that proposal, and this is something else that we've done with applications, another way to address environmental effects from water takes, not just residual flows, but also reconfiguration of takes. And so the Lindis is probably the kind of larger scale example of that, closing three races and having a dispersed system of small takes. With the Pigburn, three of the water users were actually going to move their points of take and put them to one point of take because of that particular location we'd identified. It was identified that it was a gaining reach, they would have less impact on the values in the river. And so that's a big reconfiguration because two of those water users had exercised, my understanding, had exercised priority against, one against the other. And so moving forward, they were letting go of that and actually having a shared piece of infrastructure going forward. Two of the other water users, which had used their priorities in that example, and it's actually written in the application that that they had had the priority one had exercised priority over priority five, and that they were going to enter into a side agreement to acknowledge that they had those priorities, that those priorities had been utilised by priority one, and that they were entering into a legal side agreement outside of the consent process to try and address that, to protect that priority holders, priority one's access to water. And so in that was, the example in that case.
Was that the Pigburn you've just been talking about?
Yes, that was the Pigburn.
And then you mentioned the Kyburn.
Yep, so the Kyburn was another example. In that case, again, we had a system of residuals throughout the whole catchment, with a key kind of residual at the bottom of the catchment before it enters the Tairi River. There was also a water supply agreement. They formed a company. Was it a company or some kind of legal entity? And that had with it not just its constitution, but a water supply agreement or a water sharing agreement as to how those water users within that catchment, and from memory, it's a few years ago now, but there might have been 16, 18 different water users, were going to manage the flow sharing within that catchment down to the residuals at the bottom of the catchment.
So that flow sharing agreement, was that a formal agreement and part of the consenting process, or was that outside of all that, side agreement?
It was a side agreement, yeah. So I'm not, from memory, I don't think it was mentioned in any of the conditions of consent. I'd have to go back and check, but from memory I don't think it was. And so Ms. McKeague is more involved in the detail of developing those supply agreements with clients than I am. So she'll be very well placed to talk you through some of the details of that.
So just going back to that principle that you said drove a lot of the work, which is that I think it was nobody gains to the detriment of another water user. And I was just trying to understand that a little bit better. Is that water user in the sense of an abstractor of water?
Yes. So that's very much So the first principle was about, well, the environment, looking at what the environment needs. And that means the assumption there is that everybody, all the abstractors, will be losing something. You know, they will be losing reliability of supply or access to the water to some degree, because you start with how much the environment will need. And so when you're then looking at people's loss of access, it's trying to do it in a fair way that takes into account historic access, including priorities. But it might also not be a priority. It might be that one person was just lucky enough to have their taken a gaining reach, or was upstream and there wasn't a priority, so could get access to water. But it's very much about, just trying to be as fair as possible so that everybody's going to lose a bit, but not to the detriment, or nobody's going to gain at the detriment to somebody else as well.
So it's a negotiation process, is it? So you might,
very much so.
Might think of it
very much so
that way. So I guess trying to understand the extent to which there are priorities in all of these areas. Is there a sort of go-to source for that you've used when you've been doing your work, or does that just have to be done on an individual basis,
so
going through the historic permits and things?
It's very much conversation with the permit holders themselves. So some permits will have a priority on them, but they have never been used. So you can start with the permit, but that will only tell you so much. That a legal right exists. But so of the two examples that I put in my supplementary evidence, the first, the priorities is the pig burn, and priorities have been utilised there. The second, I think, was in Lauder, and those particular priorities between those two permit holders, my understanding is that they haven't been exercised. So it completely depends on the permit holders.
You have to ask the permit holders whether they've been exercised, and if they haven't owned the land particularly long, they may not actually know.
They will... Not so much about the length of land ownership, because often that's part of the due diligence in buying a property, is not just the face value of your permit, but also actually your access to water under that permit, and that's very much informed by the priority on the permit and whether... So if you're a lower order, if you're two or lower, whether the higher priorities have exercised their right and whether that restricts access. So, you know, and our company has done due diligence in terms of purchasing properties, and that's very much a factor in understanding that access to water is whether the priority has been utilised.
But I'm just a little unclear about that. If it hasn't been exercised, that doesn't necessarily mean that it couldn't be exercised future.
That's true.
Yeah. So it might be a red flag sort of issue.
Yep, absolutely.
Yes.
And so if there's a property with a higher priority than you, you and your neighbour have a very stable relationship for years, your neighbour hasn't exercised their higher priority, they sell their property, the new owner is entitled to start exercising it. And I'm sure there are examples of where that's happened. I'm not actually aware of where that's happened, but I'm sure there are examples.
So if you're working with a group, is the example that you've given, or some other group, and so they all agree that, okay, well, if there are issues about priorities, we're either not going to worry about that, or we're going to do something on the side agreement that isn't going to damage the overall basis that we're proceeding on. If you're doing applications, do you mention the word priorities at all? do you set out? Is there anything in your AE that talks about priorities?
There might be passing reference. And when we do have a section on in our AEs in terms of effects on other water users, often because we do them as group applications on a subcatchment basis, so that's within, you know, a tributary, a contained kind of system of priorities, then that's already been addressed in the proposal internally. So it won't always be explicitly recognised in, say, that section of the AEE. In the pig burn, we did mention it very briefly and pretty much to say that the other priorities were being set aside, but the priorities between, I think it was priority one and five, were being addressed in a side agreement. I can't actually remember if we specifically mentioned it in the Kai burn. So a lot of the time, it forms part of the background work within the group, and it's about the group coming to an agreed position after the environmental aspects, all the other environmental aspects looking after the waterway have been addressed.
Can you say that again? I'm sorry, I lost the thread of what you were saying.
So it's often contained within the proposal, but it won't be explicit. So it very much forms part of the development of the proposal in terms of the management between themselves, whether it's a water supply agreement. But it's probably, I don't think we often mention it explicitly in the application in detail, how it's being dealt with. Often if there is a water supply agreement, we'll mention that there's a water supply agreement. That may reference back to the priorities, or it may just be this is how this group proposes to flow share down to these limits and manage to the limits. And perhaps that reflects the fact that it's very much been something between water users historically, and that the council hasn't been involved and managing, so quite possibly that's a reflection of that.
So I've noted your evidence is albeit that the applicants for resource consent will have proposed a new take and use of water, taking into consideration existing priorities, those priorities are managed as between water users is often not mentioned on a resource consent
application.
Application. And secondly, you may or may not mention the existence of water share agreement in an application for resource consent.
No, sorry, I'd reframe that to say we do mention that there will be a water supply agreement, but it might not reference back specifically to how it replaces priorities. So we do note where there's going to be a water supply agreement or a water sharing agreement.
So what's the difference between a water supply agreement and a water sharing agreement? You're using different terminology.
Sorry, I should just use one. I'm just using them interchangeably there. I suppose technically water supply agreement is more about an irrigation scheme and its supply agreement to its shareholders and a water sharing agreement is the agreement between abstractors to how they're going to manage their access to the water body. Yeah.
So you've been referring to water sharing agreements?
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry.
So some of these applications that you're involved with, presumably it may not be possible to get everyone in the tent. Some people may have got new water consents already, for example.
So in the Manahirikia, yes, there are some outside of the tent. Some went through earlier. Although one of the main ones to go through earlier in that example was the Hawkden-Ideburn scheme, which reconsented in 2001 and were granted long-term permits, but they are still formally part of the Manahirikia catchment group and have been active members of that group. There are a few, maybe three, five permit holders, I think, that I can think of off the top of my head that aren't formally part of Manahirikia catchment group approach, which I think is quite remarkable considering just how many permit holders there are and the geographical spread of them.
So how do you deal with that, the fact that not everybody's in the tent?
So we anticipate that whatever minimum flow limit will be imposed, they will also have that imposed on their permits.
You mean that the regional council will yes. review their permits and do that even though you're not the council
no.
setting the minimum flow and the allocation limit that you've got your group working to?
Yep, so I was actually referring then to people who had current applications who were replacing their permit. So if, you know, there's a minimum flow proposed for that catchment, that we'd anticipate that it would be, you know, a condition of their consent as well.
But you're relying on the regional
absolutely.
Council to review those.
Oh, well,
those
if they're a current application.
Other permits, if they're not current applications.
Yes, we have no control over that.
As a matter of interest, how many permit holders are there in the Manahirikia who have consents which are still running and are not going to be expiring before 2025?
Oh, I couldn't tell you that number off the top of my head. I'm sorry. I know the Hawkden-Ideburn company who takes water above Falls Dam is the key one. I'd say I think there are very few.
When you say Hawkden-Ideburn?
Hawkden-Ideburn.
They are the key one in what respect? What do you mean by that? Because they've got a long-term consent? Which is still running beyond 2025?
Yeah, they're the only one I'm aware of. And because they're an irrigation company rather than a single permit, you know, a single landowner, so they're supplying water and they transport it all the way from the top of the Manahirikia Valley over into the Tairi catchment. But they're the only one I actually know of. In terms of surface water abstraction. That's not to say that there might not be a few others, but if there are others, I'd imagine that they'd be, you know, small individual landowners. Oh, there were some that were, there was the Jops, I can't remember the name of their station, that were replaced maybe 4 years ago, but not ones that we've been dealt, that I've dealt with myself.
And is your assumption that if Manahirikia is processed according to the application and granted, that the Hawkden-Ideburn Irrigation Company will be reviewed in line with whatever is set on the application or applications which are now before the Regional Council for Manahirikia?
I wouldn't say it's my assumption.
Well, does that need to take place or not?
I think a separate assessment of their impacts would be helpful.
Does it need to take place in the sense that it is important to review that existing water permit to enable whatever has been proposed for the wider Manahirikia catchment to take place?
I don't think it's critical for the health of the water body in the Manahirikia
itself.
No,
I'm talking about abstractor interests only.
I think it would be useful to review it, definitely. I think it would be a good thing to do to bring things into line. Yes.
Is the exercise of the new proposal for Manahita Care contingent upon a review of the Hawkden Ideburn?
No.
All right, that's all I was getting
at. Yeah.
Sorry, Catherine.
So the work you've been doing, you've just factored that consent that's outside the tent in as a given.
That's right.
So, So having done that, that would have affected everyone else in terms of the work that you're doing.
Not hugely, because they're above Falls Dam, and so because it is such a complex catchment with, storage of water at the top of the catchment that then can augment flows downstream in summer, and that takes above the dam, so it has a lesser impact in terms of what...
Sure, yeah. But there must be other examples where...
They've already been granted.
Yes, that could have quite a major impact in terms of the principle that you've been working to, if they were in the tent as well and being reviewed.
Yeah, I can't think of another example in terms of a permit with, that would either undermine the proposal or they would be scattered amongst tributaries. And I know, so I'm thinking of one example, the other one I mentioned, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the station name or that, their actual applicant's name, because it wasn't one I dealt with. They've still been part of the discussion about the future of water management within that tributary. So they have still been brought into discussions about flow sharing within that particular tributary. At the bottom of that, meeting the residual flow that we've proposed for that trip.
So they've been brought into the discussions, but with what outcome?
I'm not actually familiar with that specific. I haven't worked on that tributary, sorry.
So most of the applications that you've been involved with and are aware of, do you have any expectation in terms of review clauses?
Yes, and we've got much more specific detailed review clauses on recent consents granted for water abstraction in Otago. And I think most permit holders now with this process are aware that, if they got granted a permit now, that, say, if they were in the Tairi, that the minimum flow could possibly change as a result of the limit setting process under the NPS as part of the FMU process. And that could very well result in a review of their permit. So I think... that's now much, much more an accepted part of it.
So is that there's explicit review clauses that signal that future, the NPS FM review and the likely change to the plan and those sort of things,
yes,
triggering a review?
Yes.
But it still requires the council to...
It does.
Undertake the review.
Yeah, and that has been something that's been...
trigger the review.
That's right. And that has been foreshadowed in Otago. That was the approach that was going to be taken under the operative plan in terms of those 2A, the Schedule 2A catchment where there was a minimum flow set in the Tairi. As an example of that, we were getting new permits issued... but no, the minimum flow isn't a condition of consent on those permits, but people know that, or anticipated, because the plan said it would happen, that once all deemed permit applications were in, or at 2021, the minimum flow for the Tairi would be applied to their permits. So we've actually had some permit holders who have been voluntarily flow sharing in anticipation of that, to meet the minimum flow, even though it's not actually a current condition of their consent.
Sorry, I just need to switch horses. I've just got a few other things that are... So, you may not be able to help me with this, tell me if you can, but where you might have irrigation that's supplying a variety of purposes, mm-hmm. so you might be providing stock water, drinking water for people, mm-hmm. and then you've got your standard sort of irrigation to support your pastoral activity or your particular horticultural activities. Mm-hmm. Are all of those things broken down in the different activities and the different allocations that are being sought? Are all of those separately broken down in an application that you're involved with?
So for those large... For the large schemes, what we do is we undertake a mapping exercise and identify and we utilise Aqualink as a bit of a template here because everything has been assessed against those efficiency requirements, and Aqualink uses at a kind of a broad level using water for pasture, viticulture, and then I think it's cherries. But we apply, so the cherries one is applied to horticulture in general, and then market gardening, which is really an North Otago thing in terms of how Aqualink have developed it. So those are the kind of the high-level categories in terms of land use, the pasture, the viticulture and the horticulture. And then on top of that, we identify... where it's required, stock water and the needs for stock water, frost fighting and the requirements based on kind of a, you know, frost fighting requirements in an area, and some allowance for distribution losses. Domestic, a lot of schemes don't actually supply water as potable water. So there may be some users who utilise water for domestic supply, but that's not actually part of their water supply agreement. So we haven't factored that in for the larger schemes. For on an individual farm level or a much smaller focused application, again, it's identifying, you know, whether they're using their water for pasture, horticulture, viticulture. And so sometimes it's quite complex. Depending on the application and their water use, where people also have some amenity areas that they might water or lifestyle blocks, and so we try to acknowledge that and group it in to, say, pasture or horticulture, one of those two. So try to acknowledge their use. And then the application itself will detail, if it's a smaller application specific to private permit holders, it goes through and outlines what they do on their farm and the breakdown of what they're doing with the water in terms of area, what infrastructure they're using. So we do try to give that, you know, specific information as possible in terms of what's happening on the properties.
So we've heard either cross-examination suggesting to the contrary, and we have, and evidence of a highly generalised nature also suggesting to the contrary, that it's not possible to understand what is the area under irrigation. Is it your evidence that that is wrong, because that information is being supplied now by applicants for water permits?
So I think just... trying to understand what, in terms of your reference, so we do know the irrigated area at the moment, absolutely, and property owners can identify that. I think the concern was about the providing proof based on a certain date of particularly retrospectively of an irrigation area. So being able to prove categorically one way or another that an irrigation area was in by a certain date. So it was the more the date reference that was the issue. But
why is that an issue?
But again, that wasn't within the context of the controlled activity rule and keeping the process very simple.
Why is that an issue? In the context of a controlled activity rule, why is it an issue for any irrigation company with a water any irrigation company supplying water, or alternatively, any farmer taking water and using water to establish what area of land was under irrigation?
At a particular
at
date.
At a particular date.
Yeah.
I don't understand what the issue is.
And I was thinking particularly about the Manahiri Care there, where they have 300 shareholders, over 2,000 hectares, and land being subdivided, sold. Irrigation is not static in terms of...
Just pause a second. If we take the Manahiri Care as the example, with 300 shareholders... to what's the name of the entity, the company there?
Manahiri Care Irrigation Cooperative Society.
Okay, the Cooperative Society, 300 shareholders to that. Those shareholders are party to a flow sharing agreement.
A water supply agreement.
A water supply agreement.
Yep.
That water supply agreement, does it note, or is it agnostic, it doesn't note at all, what the area of land is to be irrigated?
It does, but that's based on a very outdated Ministry of Works calculation, which isn't actually accurate in terms of what's happening on the ground.
Okay, so the water share agreement for Manahiri Care Cooperative Society is inaccurate in terms of what is actually happening on the ground. That's your evidence?
Yes, in terms of there's a mismatch there between how the supply agreement works in terms of what they have to... or what they've signed up for in terms of their shareholding and then the water that they receive from the company compared to what they might actually do on the ground. On the ground, they might irrigate less and they might not take their full allocation from the company. The water supply agreement just speaks to their entitlement. So they might only irrigate half of that, or some of them may be able to spread that water further because as I understand it, the calculations, the old Ministry of Works calculations, probably, you know, wouldn't be something that might be amended in today's terms. So that's really about that legal entitlement in terms of the supply that the landowner can ask for and then the payment that they give to the company as well or to the society.
If the Regional Council is interested in understanding what the area of land is under irrigation, what information should it be supplied as part of a controlled activity?
It starts with a number, but I always think your numbers have to be supported by something, so then it would be mapping to support that number as well.
And that mapping applies to, obviously, an area of land, which may or may not be under the whole parcel of land under irrigation in any one year.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be very normal. Some blocks are irrigated, other blocks are rested, and that changes year on, year out.
Yep.
And it depends on what crop rotation is happening, and it also depends on what stock has been put to the land. Is that not so?
Yes, or if you're in the process of changing your setup. And I think the date and the rule, was it 2018, 2019? So it was my concern was more centred about going back to a particular date and just going through that process. And targeting a specific date retrospectively and saying, okay, on this date, what was your irrigated area? And give us proof that it was that on that date or on that season.
And you're saying that farmers would not have a record available from 2018?
or specific or some kind of proof specific to that date. I don't. It's not an insurmountable.
It's not an insurmountable, and that's the point, isn't it? It's presented as an insurmountable in this case, but I don't think it is. And so I'm trying to draw out of you what, if this is an important control, should the regional council be looking at?
So I definitely don't see it as an insurmountable. It was my concern around that was more focused on keeping the controlled activity pathway as simple as possible. And
understood,
so,
but yeah. Now we're driving into the detail.
Yeah.
So what's the detail that the regional council would look for in order to establish what is the area under irrigation?
Yeah. And so I think, again, it's a number supported by maps, and, you know, whether that's current irrigation area at the date that it's lodged, is the line in the sand, or within, you know, a span of a particular number of seasons may be helpful. One of those options.
Presumably that area under irrigation, if it is a line in the, if there's a date line in the sand somewhere, would reflect the setup of the irrigation the setup of the irrigation systems as of that date.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry, Catherine.
So I just wanted to understand, you talked about a water sharing agreement. So how does that relate to a low flow management regime? I've forgotten the actual terminology at the moment. Or a rationing agreement?
A rationing, low flow, sharing agreement, a sharing agreement, all pretty similar things. So all of them require, as a starting point, a limit. And so setting the limit is the critical thing, because that's all the background work goes into that. Actually, what is the limit? What does the limit need to be? What are the values? And what is required to protect those values, and what's appropriate?
So when you say limit, what do you mean?
So a minimum flow limit or a residual flow limit. So what are we managing the abstraction down to? And so...
Sorry, finish your answer.
And so it's in a water... it's in an abstractor's best interest not to hit the limit and then be turned off. So what they try to do is to reduce their take as they approach a limit, so that they've still got some access to water. Some small access to water is better than complete turn-off once you reach a limit. So the limit is an incentive. So that flow sharing begins as flows drop down towards the limit. So that's, you know, people reducing their take down to that limit. And in a kind of a cooperative sense, and I'm definitely not, I'm not the one within our kind of team that has, you know, actively developed these. Mr. Hickey and Ms. McKeague are probably, you know, more involved in this than I am. But it is about, it may be proportional reductions, you know, across the different abstractors as flows start to drop. So everybody drops back to 80% of their take, or, you know, and then down to 60% and down like that. Or it can be turnabout. You have water one day, I have water the next day, again at a reduced limit. And then, with the aim of keeping some abstraction available while not, you know, hitting that limit, whatever that limit may be.
So you've given me the minimum flows and residual flows, but you haven't mentioned primary and supplementary allocation.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that mesh with this?
Okay, so supplementary allocation is not even in the picture at that stage. So we've got the two bands of water The supplementary allocation are when flows are higher in the river. So by the time you're even really getting down to any kind of flow sharing as flows are dropping, we're only talking about the primary allocation. So, you know, sharing within that primary allocation block down to the residual and minimum flow limit. So there are flow limits set for supplementary, but the supplementary allocation is allocated in bands, and so and the kind of the access to water is it's not so critical. It's not at a time when, you know, you've got your crop going, dry conditions, flows are dropping. It's about accessing water when it's available to fill storage. So it's a whole different scenario. So really these flow sharing agreements are within primary allocation only.
And to go back to my question, you talked about limits, but you didn't talk about primary allocation limits. So how does that fit into what you're talking about?
So these water users or abstractors, all these permits are within the primary allocation block, and so they have the ability to apply for their permit because they qualify as being within that primary allocation block. The policies that are, you know, talked about as the sinking lid policies apply and are a factor in terms of when we're developing the application. Water that they haven't had a history of accessing, they know they're not going to be able to apply for it under those policies. And so it's that lesser of their history of use and the equivalent calculation of what's efficient that they will be able to reconsent as or seek replacement allocation for under the operative plan. That's a very long-winded answer.
I'm just not sure whether the environmental purpose of these allocation limits is coming into it. You've mentioned efficiency.
The key factor, and you know, we're working within the framework of the current plan in terms of these current applications. So there's in my opinion the key mechanism at the moment to look after values, in-stream values, and other values that, you know, aren't abstractive values, is through the minimum flow limits and through the residual flows, because those sinking lid policies do reduce down the allocation, but at the moment they only, in terms of environmentally, they speak to efficiency, only being able to take the water that, you know, is efficient or reasonable for your purpose of use, and that you've historically been able to access. So that's how the current plan is set up. So we have seen in some of the applications that have been granted, we have seen some quite significant drops in allocation across a subcatchment or a catchment, and that's beyond just a reduction in paper water, but actually a reduction even to their actual abstraction as well, so below their history of use. And that has been, and then that's further affected as well in terms of their reliability of supply with the setting of minimum flow limits. So setting the minimum flow or the residual flow that essentially keeps the most reliable water for the water body and other values that have been identified.
I think we did have some evidence about how allocation limits can have environmental benefits. You weren't here for that, presumably, or you don't agree with that, or because you're working within what you see as the current framework of the plan, you don't see that allocation limits have an environmental benefit other than in the efficiency of use sense.
I think they can. I think the key to in my opinion, the key mechanism for that, though, is the setting of a minimum, a flow limit. So not an allocation limit, but a flow limit, whether that be called a residual, a minimum, or a, you know, it's called other things in different regions. So I think that if you get that right, then you'll set aside that most reliable flow in the waterway for values. Once that's done, the allocation, it is still relevant, but it has a lesser impact if you get the flow limit right.
Yes, I think the evidence related to fluctuation of flows are not necessarily driving things down to the minimum flow, so you don't get that variability.
That's right. And so that is something that we look at with our applications. We do look at things like flushing flows and the variability. I think there was some strong information in the Manahira Care that there was there was a very limited effect on holding flows down in terms of abstraction had a very small effect on that variability. I think it was in terms of flushing flows on periphyton, it was changed 3 months duration by an additional 3 weeks. So that is something that we look at in terms of the applications, and it's important as well that the flow sharing agreements, because there's an incentive for water users not to hit the minimum flow, so then they all have to turn off to try and keep it above. And so what tends to happen, it's I think very difficult from what I understand to keep it at a static level, and so they'll drop their rate of abstraction, and then it's really about sharing amongst themselves the access. The more abstractors you've got, it's really about them having to share that as they drop it down and try to keep above that minimum flow. And so the flow will drop, will bounce around a bit because many variables.
Sure, understand, yeah. But that's within quite a confined band if you're aiming for the minimum flow or to be above the minimum flow. Anyway, I don't feel I need to explore that anymore. So I guess my last line of questioning relates to this vexed issue of duration of consent and the situation where people claim that they need to be doing X and Y and Z, and this is going to be very costly, and so they need a long duration to their consent. And I think that you did have a number of questions relating to your drafting proposition for that, but I really wanted more to know about your experience with the durations that are being given, with one of the reasons being advanced, the work that needs to be put in and the cost of it and those sort of things. So are you able to briefly explain your experience with durations and that work that needed to be done, an argument for a lengthy period of time as part of the decision making in the end?
Sure. So because we've developing the application, because it's in the round with all the different factors, and because we have still some historical, you know, these are kind of long-held permits rather than, say, in other parts of the country where there are new schemes, long-held permits used for many, many years on these properties. And we're setting, for the first time, flow limits in, you know, in terms of residual flows particularly, as well as minimum flows. Then often, as soon as you change that access that and affect the reliability of supply, then it does result in requirements to change what you're doing on farm very frequently. And so people have been investing in storage in the, you know, in the past years, and also with very strong messaging about needing to be efficient, have been investing in efficient infrastructure. But there's also a large group of people, you know, it all depends on your appetite for risk, your financial status, is, you know, it's huge variation. Other people haven't done that yet and have been waiting for the outcome of their permits before they do that, and been wanting to know what those limits were going to be in terms of just how much access they might lose, what how much reliability of supply was going to change. And so it's very much about the on-farm changes that they were anticipating having to make, and then getting financing for that. And I have been to hearings recently where there's been evidence from the permit holder's banker saying that they need, you know, 15 to 20 years in terms of, you know, that's what the bankers are looking for in terms of security for their investment.
So you have a group of people who've gone ahead, been more proactive, been getting things underway.
Yeah.
You've described another group of people who are sitting back and now saying, well, I need a much longer period of time in order to be able to do these things. And then you've got the potential for the NPS process for the fresh water that's to play out, that's going to put quite a different complexion, potentially, at least in some places, on the regime that they will be working within. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors at play here, isn't there?
Oh, it is. It's hugely complex. It really is. And yeah, I think it's incredibly stressful on people, both those who have invested already and had the expectation based on what they could see happening around them in terms of long-term permits being granted. And so had gone ahead with investments on that basis, and then other people who had for whatever reason wanted to wait and see. So it's a very complex situation from that respect.
And then you've also got to look at the paradigm shift and the need to make sure that you're not going to compromise that. So
And I think one of the most complex kind of examples in the mix potentially is some of the large dams, where I think they do need to have work done on them, and probably that's important from a health and safety perspective and from a risk perspective. And I'm not sure how they're going to manage that with a 6-year permit. Those large dams, whether that work just goes on hold, and those, I don't know the legalities of that in terms of, you know, the potential exposure of the often volunteer kind of directors that sit and are responsible for those large dams.
So in terms of duration and setting some better guidance or parameters around that, have you given that any thought? Because it's very easy just to talk about future investment and work that's going to be required. I mean, that would be pretty universal, I'd imagine, across the deemed permit areas. Have you given some other thought to how duration might be better directed, other than an absolute figure like 6 years or 10 years or whatever?
I think in my evidence in chief, I made some amendments to the current policy on term in the operative plan. And I'm just trying to recall what I put in my supplementary about that. Can I just
Sure.
have a look? Yeah.
Whether there's scope for such thing is another question, but we won't go there at this stage.
So I didn't address that specifically in terms of, you know, I had the no more than 20 years, but also discussed in the Section 32 evaluation about whether, you know, whether it's hard to land on a number, but that 15 years might be appropriate as well. And so I guess where I was trying to go with that rule was to try and do exactly that, to try and indicate where it might be acceptable or appropriate, or the things that you might try and think about in terms of, you know, justifying longer than 6 years at the moment with all the complications that we've just discussed. And so that was really about, you know, are there factors where there are critical environmental effects that that could or should be addressed now, and that was the threatened species, a clearly degrading waterway, and linking that in to requirements to try and to ensure that was done in a manner that was as consistent as possible with the MPS requirements, and that those kind of circumstances tied in with the investment, the need for investment. So really, you know, trying to build into that where the considerations might be that you might consider a longer term than 6 years.
Okay, thank you.
Right, well, we'll take the morning adjournment and then come back to the rest of the questions from the court. Before we do, Ms Irving, courts asked you to provide details as to either the district court rules or section that you're relying on. You haven't responded. You are to respond.
Yes. You know, we're working on that. I've got a dictation with my secretary, so it shouldn't be too far away.
Well, even if it's an email, it's just that it requires a decision from the court. Sure. And I don't see why I should be chasing through the district court rules to figure out which provision you're relying on. It's just good court craft. Okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please all stand. Thank you.